Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be your host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The Actual Meaning of the Constitution's Commerce and Power, and Congress and the Court's Use or Abuse of It. I will be introducing Mr. Carl Graham. He is the director of the Center for Self-Government in the West of the Sutherland Institute.
Thank you. And I just got introduced, and now I'm going to introduce Rob Nadelson, who's our speaker. Rob practiced law for about 11 years in two different states before becoming a law professor, mostly at the University of Montana, and he did that for about 25 years. His work is best known for constitutional issues, founding area constitutional law, constitutional history. In 2010, right, did I write that down correctly? 2010, Rob retired, took early retirement from U of M, and he now works at the Independence Institute in Colorado, where he writes extensively on constitutional law. And in fact, during the 2012 Supreme Court term, his writings were cited 12 times in different decisions. Rob's written a couple of books, Origins of the Necessary and Proper Clause, and also The Original Constitution, which is available back at the back of the room there, if that interests you, for sale. And today he'll be talking to us about the meaning of the commerce power and Congress's and the court's use and abuse of that power. So please join me in welcoming Rob Nadelson.
Thanks, Carl. I think I've got a double microphone here. Is this volume okay for everybody? Okay. This is a bit of a homecoming for me. When I was teaching at the University of Montana, one day I got a call from the dean at the University of Utah, and he said, we need somebody to fill some courses at University of Utah Law School next year. Would you be interested? And I said, well, gee, I don't know. He said, well, let me tell you what we're going to pay you. Well, it was about 50% higher than what I was getting at Montana. And when you factored in the deductions, my take home here was about 77% higher. So like other academics, being totally indifferent to money, I said, sure, I'll come. Absolutely. And it was a great decision. I just had a wonderful time here. I did and my family did. And my youngest daughter, Sarah, was born here. She is, in fact, a Utahn born in Salt Lake City. So it's great to be back. Now, normally I don't read speeches, but this is a very sprawling topic. And so in order to get the amount of material that I've got into the time available, I've written out the speech. And those of you who have questions, there'll be plenty of time for Q&A right after it. Knowing about our Constitution requires us to understand that it created a federal government of fairly limited scope. That might seem to be a basic fact of which every citizen should be aware, but many are not. When I was teaching the Constitution to law students, I discovered that many, perhaps even most students, had managed to get through high school, college, and a year of law training without ever having learned it. But the limit on federal power remains a fundamental aspect of the founders' achievement. In the words of Justice Anthony Kennedy, the founders, quote, split the atom of sovereignty. That is, they not only divided power between the three branches of the federal government, which the British had done before them, but they also divided power between the federal government and the states. Why did they do this? Well, as Justice Sandra Day O'Connor has pointed out, they did not do this for the purpose of protecting states' rights. They did it for the purpose of fragmenting government power to better protect individual liberty. The founders sought to accomplish this division of power in three ways. First, they consciously rejected the British idea of an unwritten common law type constitution. Instead, they adopted a written constitution that marked the federal government's jurisdiction in clear language. And that language was clear. Some of the terms in the Constitution may seem to us obscure, but during the founding era, they were readily comprehensible by lay people, except for a few, which were legislative and legal terms that were well known among politicians and lawyers. Examples of these legislative and legal terms were, and you'll see these phrases in the Constitution, privileges and immunities, habeas corpus, the recess of the Senate, and necessary and proper. The second way the founders divided power was by itemizing the areas the federal government could address. They did so by listing or enumerating federal powers. The best known enumeration appears in Article 1, Section 8, but there are other enumerations scattered around the instrument. Some of them give power to Congress, some to the President, some to the judiciary, and some even to state legislatures and conventions. Next, the founders adopted the Ninth and Tenth Amendments to reinforce the message that the authority of the federal government was limited to the Constitution's enumerated powers. Obviously, understanding how this system was supposed to work requires us to know what the words of the Constitution actually mean. To a remarkable degree, the rules and limitations in the Constitution are still generally honored. But some are not. Among the two of the provisions that are not generally honored, at least their original meaning is not honored, are the two clauses that together comprise what lawyers call the commerce power. One of these two components is called the Commerce Clause, and I've included its language on the handout. The Commerce Clause states, "The Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes." The portion of the Commerce Clause we're concerned about today is the portion that grants Congress authority to, quote, regulate commerce among the several states. The other component of the Commerce Clause is called the other component of the Commerce Power is called the Necessary and Proper Clause because it grants to Congress power to make laws that are necessary and proper for carrying out its other authority, including its authority to regulate commerce. Several years ago, I undertook an investigation into the founding era meaning of the phrase to regulate commerce. What did that mean, to regulate commerce? I did some of my work in America and some of it at libraries in England. I traveled to England, notably to Oxford, because during the 18th century, American constitution writers and lawyers closely followed English terminology and precedent. The English and ourselves had really one legal system. And England was the best place to study those subjects. Before embarking on my research, I knew that some libertarian legal writers claimed that in the 18th century, the word commerce had a very narrow meaning, that it pertained only to buying and selling among merchants. And furthermore, I knew that these writers argued that Congress could facilitate that trade, but that Congress had no authority to actually ban or block items in commerce. On the other hand, I knew that more liberal writers had claimed that commerce had a very broad meaning, that any and all economic activity was commerce. So if you run a ma and pa store, that's commerce by that argument. And that therefore Congress could regulate any economic activity it wished. And finally, I knew that a handful of prominent liberal professors were arguing that commerce encompassed human relations of every kind and that the commerce power was nearly unlimited. To get at the truth, I dug into 18th century documents discussing commerce and the regulation thereof. I looked at English and American court cases decided before 1790. I found over 470 uses of the word commerce in these court cases. Some people get their jollies in very odd ways. I also found a vast number of usages and explanations in 18th century legal and lay dictionaries, treatises, histories, and many other founding era sources. Here's what I learned. First, the prevailing meaning of the words to regulate commerce was not quite limited to regulating trade among merchants. It included activities tightly connected to that trade. To regulate commerce included also authority to regulate cargo insurance, commercial finance, international brokerage, marketplaces, navigation, and other forms of commercial transportation. So on that score, the libertarian writers were wrong. Second, I learned that regulation of commerce could and commonly did include restrictions on trade. It could include tariffs, embargoes, and flat bans on certain kinds of goods and transactions. Again, to that extent, the libertarian writers were wrong. On the other hand, I also learned that regulating commerce was a distinct legal concept, separate from governing other kinds of activities, both economic and non-economic. Regulating commerce was different from controlling morals or crime or naturalization. It was also different from regulating economic subjects, such as bankruptcy, intellectual property, land use, roads, manufacturing, health care, and most other services, business ownership, insurance, other than cargo insurance, which was commerce, labor relations, agriculture, or mining. None of the items on this list were considered commerce. The Constitution did grant Congress power over some of those items, such as bankruptcy and intellectual property, patents and copyrights, but it did so by grants separate from the commerce power. The remainder, including most economic regulation, was left exclusively to the states. So to that point, to that extent, the liberal writers were wrong. I further discovered that the Constitution's line between federal and state jurisdiction was closely akin to a division that American colonial writers had advocated before the Constitution. Now, if you know your revolutionary history, you may know that before the war, American lawyers such as John Dickinson, James Wilson, had argued that Britain should regulate commerce and navigation among units of the British Empire, but otherwise should permit the colonies to govern themselves. When writing the Constitution after the war, Dickinson, Wilson, and the other framers gave Congress a limited taxing power, but for the most part, they did the same thing with the federal government that they had wanted to do with Britain. They granted to the federal government what they had conceded to Britain, the power to regulate trade, navigation, and so forth, and left to the states almost everything else they had claimed for the colonies. In the course of my investigation, I learned that this division was reinforced during the public debates over whether the Constitution should be ratified. It's not commonly known, but the Constitution's supporters repeatedly reassured the American people that the states would retain exclusive jurisdiction over most areas of life. The Constitution supporters were very specific about this. In a series of essays and speeches, they told the public that the federal government would have little or no power over any of the following activities within state boundaries: manufacturing, agriculture, real estate, inheritance, licensing, most civil lawsuits, most criminal law, regulation of local businesses, religion, social services, and education. How quaint that sounds today. Those making these representations included James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Tench Coxe, highly influential, perhaps as influential as Madison and Hamilton on the ratification, James Wilson, and others. Finally, I learned that the founders did not erect walls between federal and state authority because they thought that these activities were somehow sealed off from each other in tight little boxes. On the contrary, the founders repeatedly talked about how commerce, manufacturing, agriculture, personal behavior, and other activities were all interconnected. Yet for purposes of government regulation, they decided to separate them. This was a conscious decision. The Constitutional Convention actually had considered two proposals to empower Congress to regulate any activity with interstate effects, but the delegates emphatically rejected both of them. Instead, their Constitution deliberately divided jurisdiction between interconnected activities between different levels of government, and this arrangement was confirmed explicitly during the ratification. The basic idea was that the power had to be divided to secure the benefits of liberty and local government, of local control. They gave the federal government considerable authority to deal with spillover effects between the states, but they did not give the federal government total authority. If a problem arose that was outside the enumerated powers, then it had to be dealt with in a different way, such as by an interstate compact or by a constitutional amendment. In addition to the Commerce Clause, the other component of Congress's commerce power is the Necessary and Proper Clause. In modern times, the Necessary and Proper Clause has been the subject of much misunderstanding. Google it on the web, and you will find the Necessary and Proper Clause referred to as an elastic clause that gives the Congress vast power. This despite the fact that numerous founders specifically said that the Necessary and Proper Clause actually gives no power at all. Others have gone to the other extreme and claim that the Necessary and Proper Clause is entirely meaningless. These misunderstandings arise from failure to study adequately the record of the founding era. The historical record tells us that the Necessary and Proper Clause was only one example of a very common kind of phrase used in 18th century documents, particularly in legal documents whereby some people gave power to other people. You can find the brothers of the Necessary and Proper Clause and its sisters and its cousins and its aunts in 18th century trust instruments, in powers of attorney, in commissions given to governors, colonial governors, in instructions to agents, in court documents, and in many other places. You can also find 18th century cases explaining some of the meaning of the Necessary and Proper Clause. What the clause does is to tell us how to interpret the Constitution's grants to Congress. It says, when you interpret the authority granting authority to Congress, please don't read those words too narrowly. Instead, read them to further the intent behind the document. For example, don't limit the authority of Congress to regulate commerce only to trade among merchants. We also intend that regulating commerce may include laws governing navigation, cargo insurance, commercial finance, international brokerage, and so forth. 18th century lawyers referred to this kind of interpretation as the doctrine of incidental powers. Our first Constitution, the failed Articles of Confederation, had denied Congress any incidental powers. So the framers drafted the Necessary and Proper Clause to give Congress some wiggle room, but not too much wiggle room. The room we're talking about here is a parlor, not a stadium. There were well-recognized rules that limited the doctrine of incidental powers. Incidental powers had to be subordinate, of lesser importance than enumerated powers. For example, Congress could require manufacturers to affix labels to goods that were being shipped in interstate commerce, but that did not mean that Congress could take over the entire manufacturing process. Also, incidental powers had to be exercised for the purpose of carrying out the actual powers granted in writing. So while Congress could require labels to facilitate interstate commerce, it couldn't require labels to, let's say, subsidize the paper industry or promote the general welfare. Founding era lawyers pointed out, as the great Chief Justice John Marshall warned, that the necessary and proper clause does not authorize laws passed on pretext. Another limit on incidental powers was that there had to be a genuine reason for believing that the makers of an incidental power, that the makers of a document intended the incidental power to go with the enumerated one. For example, when the first Congress debated whether it was constitutional under the Necessary and Proper Clause to establish a national bank, advocates of the bank argued that a national bank was a customary way of allowing a government to borrow money and do the other things that the Constitution explicitly authorized. Advocates of the bank also argued that it was a necessary way in which the enumerated powers could be carried on. These were accepted methods of showing that a lesser power, in this case the bank, had been granted with a greater, in this case the power to borrow money, declare war, and so forth. Now, the founders said repeatedly that the courts would have the job of policing the boundaries between the federal government and the states. You sometimes see the argument made that John Marshall invented judicial review in Marbury versus Madison in 1803. That's not true. Judicial review had existed well before, and it was fully expected by the founders that the court would strike down laws that the federal government adopted that were outside its authority. From the time of the founding until the 1940s, the Supreme Court conscientiously did that job. You see this, for example, when you read carefully the opinions of Chief Justice Marshall, not just the shortened versions that appear in your law school casebooks, but the entire opinions, including the language that the casebook editors tend to leave out. Many Supreme Court cases decided before 1940 that police these boundaries contain language that law professors sometimes mock, such as current of commerce, flow of commerce, direct and indirect effects. But as the case opinions make clear, these were just colorful ways of telling us when Congress was acting within its incidental powers and when it was not. In the course of its duty, the Supreme Court inevitably made mistakes. For example, in 1918, in a case called Hammer versus Degenhardt, the court construed the commerce power too narrowly. It imposed a limit that the Constitution just doesn't impose. And in 1937, in a case called National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steele, the court construed congressional authority too broadly. It forgot that for Congress to exercise a power under the Necessary and Proper Clause, that power had to be subordinate to or less important to one specifically mentioned in the Constitution. Still, these cases were bona fide efforts to try to enforce the boundaries between federal and state jurisdiction. In later years, after 1940, however, the wiggle room offered by the Necessary and Proper Clause became first a stadium and then eventually something akin in size to the Bonneville salt flats. Okay. In discussing just when the Supreme Court abdicated its responsibility to police the limits on the commerce power, many writers point to the 1937 Jones and Laughlin case. Some point to a 1942 case called Wickard versus Filburn. Some of you may be aware of that. The farmer was punished for not selling wheat. But I believe the key turning point was the 1941 decision in United States versus Darby. In the Darby case, The justices ruled that Congress could use its commerce power to regulate the manufacturing process of a relatively small company. The justices adopted what constitutional lawyers call the substantial effects test. This test is that if Congress has any rational basis for thinking that any economic activity might substantially affect interstate commerce, then Congress can regulate it. In the real world, it's not much of a test at all. Darby also adopted another rule, usually identified with the later case of Wickard versus Filburn. This rule is called the aggregation principle. This allows Congress to control tiny in-state enterprises, such as ma-and-pa stores, that have virtually no effect on interstate commerce. Congress can do so if it drafts this law broadly enough to include a mass of enterprises that all together have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. The aggregation principle, by encouraging Congress to draft very broad laws, thereby creates incentives for Congress to overregulate and helps explain why our land of the free has become in large part a land of the regimented. Close reading of Darby and later decisions of the same kind revealed they were not decided under the Commerce Clause, as commonly assumed, but actually under the Necessary and Proper Clause. With the exception of a 1944 case expanding the definition of commerce to include insurance, with the exception of that, the court has never really deviated from the narrow founding era definition of commerce. Indeed, the court has repeated admittedly that federal laws that regulate labor relations, manufacturing, agriculture, crime, and marijuana plants in the window box, that they're really not regulations of commerce. They are regulations of activities that the court and Congress have decided in some way substantially affect commerce. For this reason, the Darby case and many of those after it actually explicitly or tacitly lean on the Necessary and Proper Clause. However, applying the Necessary and Proper Clause that way mutilates its meaning. That clause encapsulates the doctrine of incidental powers. It grants no authority by itself. It simply acknowledges that Congress's powers should be read, as the founders intended rather than in their strictest sense. And the intent of the founders is no mystery here. As I mentioned earlier, they repeatedly represented to the American public that activities such as manufacturing, agriculture, land use, and garden variety crime were outside of federal jurisdiction. Moreover, the doctrine of incidental powers specifically excludes laws adopted merely as pretexts for achieving unenumerated goals, and much federal legislation is really related for reasons unrelated to commerce. It's interesting that the court's rewrite of the incidental power doctrine not only contradicts the way the doctrine is supposed to apply in the Constitution, it also contradicts the way that the incidental power doctrine is applied in every other area of the law. But there's a more fundamental problem. By stretching the commerce power this way, the federal government has not interpreted the Constitution, but staged a kind of coup d'etat. It has imposed on us a constitution by which federal politicians can regulate almost anything with interstate effects, which as a practical matter means almost everything of significance. Yet this is precisely the formula that our founders emphatically rejected in favor of a list of enumerated powers. Originally, the rewriting of the commerce power was hailed as a development mandated by modern realities. You still see that argument sometimes today. Many of us, maybe most of us, now know better. The complexity of modern life is far too great for any government to control it centrally, even if that were otherwise desirable. Vain efforts to centrally control a modern economy is one reason for the collapse of the Soviet Union. And throughout the 1990s, the failure of such efforts forced radical changes in the rest of the world as well. Since that time, global trends have continued toward decentralization and toward freedom. The efforts of the United States to move in the opposite direction, to swim upstream against modern realities, have led to widespread disgust with the federal government. Look at the favorability numbers of Congress. And they have led to public distress of the kind that we now see accompanying the initiation of the Affordable Care Act. Last year, the Supreme Court, speaking through Chief Justice Roberts, upheld the Affordable Care Act's penalty for not buying insurance, and did so on the argument that it was a form of tax. But before reaching that decision, Justice Roberts had some very interesting things to say about the commerce power. He concluded that the individual insurance mandate was outside the Commerce Clause because, to quote him, it does not regulate commercial activity. It instead compels individuals to become active in commerce by purchasing a product. He also concluded that the Necessary and Proper Clause did not support the mandate either. We at the Independence Institute had filed a brief with the court on the Necessary and Proper Clause issue. This was based closely on the book that Carl mentioned, which I co-authored on the clause. Justice Roberts did not cite our brief specifically, but much of his language tracks it closely. The result is an opinion that seems to signal a shift back toward the founders' understanding. For example, Justice Roberts wrote that the clause pertains to incidental powers. He wrote that it does not actually grant Congress any additional authority, but is, quote, merely a declaration for the removal of all uncertainty. He wrote that incidental powers generally are narrow in scope, that they must be, quote, exercises of authority derivative of and in service to a granted power, end quote. And he added that they must be of smaller consequence than the, quote, great substantive and independent powers, end quote, actually conferred by the Constitution. And, Justice Roberts added, that congressional enactments that exceed the scope of constitutional authority are, quote, merely acts of usurpation, which the judiciary will declare unconstitutional. Perhaps Chief Justice Roberts was telling us that he is finally prepared to reinstate some of the intended limits on the commerce power. That remains to be seen. I realize I've dumped a whole lot on you, so I'd be happy to take any questions you might have. None? Well, thank you very much.
Come on now. Oh, I've got one then. Oh, go ahead. I'll fill it later if I have to.
So my name's Casey Levitt, and I am a physics and mathematics major here at the U. You were saying that the United States government has been getting a broader scope on increasing regulations. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it has happened to the point that the Constitution has become in vain, or do you think it ever will get to that point?
Well, first, the Constitution is a longer document than just the commerce power. I mean, there's much of the Constitution that is enforced, if not maybe exactly as the founders intended, in general. I mean, for the First Amendment, for example, is not enforced exactly as the founders intended, but the congruence is pretty okay. You know, the president still only serves 4 years. You know, we don't have Julius Caesar, who's now dictator for life. You know, so I'm not saying that the entire document has broken down, but certainly the intended limits on the size of the federal government have broken down. And there has been widespread dissatisfaction. Now, people from the right or from the left may enumerate different reasons for that dissatisfaction, but there is a disquiet in the land, as Patrick Henry might say. There's a sense that something's wrong, and I think that has something to do with this. There are a number of symptoms of this. One is the fact that Congress now has a 9% approval rating, but there are other symptoms, too. There is a movement rippling throughout the states right now to use a procedure that's never been used before, which allow the states to force constitutional amendments to rein in Congress. The balanced budget amendment is the most famous example. There are proposals for other amendments as well. And this is more than just talk. I mean, 15 states have already replied for a convention it's not a constitutional convention, applied for an Article 5 convention to insert new amendments into the Constitution. Ohio and Michigan just had votes to do so as well, although I don't know that their process is complete. So much of the Constitution survives. Maybe most of the Constitution survives with pretty much its original force. But we certainly have a much, much bigger federal government than we planned. Now, some of this is absolutely legitimate, okay? Someone might raise the argument, well, Congress can regulate commerce, and commerce includes transportation, but airlines didn't exist in 1789, and therefore Congress can't regulate airlines. That's a ridiculous argument, okay? So Congress does regulate airlines. It's a perfectly legitimate role for the federal government. So in that sense, some of the expansion was absolutely appropriate and constitutional. But it certainly, I think, has gone beyond what our written document says it ought to be.
My name is Remington Carlson.
It's the guy who's got the microphone who's yes. Trump's. Go ahead.
So you've mentioned a lot about how the federal government has kind of taken advantage of these clauses and kind of expanded their power past what the Founding Fathers originally had intended. Now, do you feel as if the scope of the federal government were to be more limited and to be narrowed down from what it is now, if that would make for an improvement in our government, and kind of what would be the best way to go about making this change?
Well, I'm going to defer on the second part of what's the best way of making the change, other than to say that I am an advocate of an Article 5 convention, that is to say, where the states get together and they force some changes in the Constitution to roll back Congress. That, by the way, is why that provision was put into the Constitution. Would things be better? Yeah, I think they would. I mean, the traditional argument against the states making this regulation is that, you know, the states don't have access to central sources of information. Some of the states are too poor, et cetera. Those arguments may have had some validity at the time, but not true today, in the day of the Internet, the day when all the states really are in a position to be able to oppose effective regulation. Let me give you a difference. Let me give you an example of what happens when the states regulate things versus what happens when the federal government regulates things. The number of people who have signed up through websites for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act is far below what expected. But what the news reports have told us is that the states that set up their own websites have registered overwhelmingly the majority of people, that the state websites work, that the federal website doesn't work. I'm not a big fan of the Affordable Care Act, but this is sort of illustrative, I think, of what happens. Now, it doesn't mean that everything always is administered all the time better at the state level, but I think that usually it is. And there are a number of different reasons for that, having to do with state constitutional restrictions, the way we elect state legislators, the fact that the states are closer to the people, and so forth. So, yeah, I think it would improve things. Yes, sir.
Hi, Jeff Dalby, a political science major. So I feel that the Constitution is a very vaguely worded document, and I believe that was intentionally the way it was made. I mean, they could go into a lot more detail than they did. One of the things they mentioned is that we have this Supreme Court that we're supposed to defer to and to follow their ruling when needed. And I kind of feel a lot of what you're saying is that is irrelevant, but the portions that you think should be followed to the letter are the ones that should supersede. Do you think that there's portions of the Constitution that should versus should not be interpreted broadly?
Well, first, your statement that the Constitution is a vague document, vaguely worded document, is very widely shared. Justice William Brennan, who was the liberal light of the Supreme Court in the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, called the many provisions of the Constitution luminous generalities. One of the points I'd like you to take home is that that's not true. That many of the provisions that are thought of as luminous generalities actually had fairly specific meanings during the 18th century. One example is the Necessary and Proper Clause. The Necessary and Proper Clause for many years was believed to be kind of an obscure clause that nobody knew what it meant, or alternatively that it was a grant of vast power. We now know fairly specifically, not to 100%, but we know fairly well what the Necessary and Proper Clause meant. Another example is the Privileges and Immunities Clause. There's a case right now which is going to go up to the Supreme Court on what's called the Recess Appointments Clause. There's a big argument between the Obama administration and others over whether the president's appointments made in the recess of the Senate are valid or not. When you actually go back and you look at the founding era meaning of the recess and vacancies and words used in the Constitution, the meaning is quite specific. So the Constitution is a heck of a lot more clear than some people give it credit for. Secondly, the people who drafted the Constitution were very skilled drafters. Most of them were lawyers. They were not only lawyers, they were super lawyers. For example, the five guys who served on the Committee of Detail that put out the first draft of the Constitution, they included the second best known lawyer in Pennsylvania, James Wilson, the best known lawyer, the Chancellor of South Carolina, John Rutledge. They included a man who wasn't a lawyer, the President of Congress. They included a man who had the largest law practice in Connecticut, and they included the man who was not only governor of Virginia, but he had served as Attorney General of Virginia for 10 years, and he had the largest law practice in Virginia. So these were super lawyers. When they put together the Constitution, they knew exactly what they were doing. And they drafted some provisions to be rather flexible, and they drafted other provisions to be rather rigid. They knew how to do both. So when they've got a provision in there which says the president is to serve for 4 years, that's four solar years, that's not four Saturn years, okay? It's a precise sort of thing. On the other hand, you look at what's called the suspension clause, the writ of habeas corpus can be suspended when in cases of invasion or insurrection the public safety may require it. Very broad. Who's going to determine ultimately whether the public safety may require it? Congress, subject to review by the courts. So they knew how to, and then there's a Necessary and Proper Clause, which is a clause which is neither extremely rigid nor extremely flexible, but somewhere in between. They knew what they were doing. The more I get into this, and the more I get into 18th century law, the more impressed I am with their achievement.
My name is Jesse Buchanan. I'm a biology major here at the U. You mentioned Chief Justice Roberts having that shift in opinion of maybe reining in power from Congress.
Maybe.
Right. Do you think any of the other justices share that opinion? And yes. Do you think there's possible change in the future?
The decision on the Affordable Care Act was 5-4. Justice Roberts was, of course, the swing vote. Four of the justices would have just struck down the whole thing, you know, everything from soup to nuts. Justice Roberts took a middle position in that he upheld the individual mandate as a tax, and he struck down to a large extent, but not completely, the provision whereby Congress had tried to force the states to expand their Medicaid programs. So there are justices who think that perhaps the feds have gone too far, but not invariably. Okay? So, for example, in 2005, there was an opinion in which the court said Congress can regulate marijuana plants that you grow in your window boxes. Justice Scalia, who's normally thought of as a guy who wants to rein in the federal government, voted for that. In other words, he voted for Congress having that authority. I think it would be really hard to argue that the founders, whatever they would have thought about marijuana, that the founders would have wanted the federal government to regulate people's window boxes. Yes, sir.
I'm Dave Atkinson. I'm a BYU Cougar.
When I was here at University of Utah, I spent some time down at the BYU Law School, had great time talking with the colleagues there about some of the more obscure kinds of things that I like to talk about. So,
Good. Very good.
I also had a great time in the student in this campus store with all the goodies.
Yeah. Go ahead.
A couple of questions I have. First one is, I think it's in your state even, where they're saying, hey, if we manufacture something within the borders of our state and it doesn't cross those boundaries, then Congress really has no authority to regulate that through the Commerce Clause. And I think the buzzword is firearms. And,
yes. You're thinking specifically of the Montana Firearms Act.
Yeah.
By my state, I wasn't sure what you meant. Montana, where I lived for so long, or Colorado.
So Congress is kind of bucking that, I guess. Right.
Congress has claimed ever since, and the Supreme Court has upheld ever since the Darby case and Wickard versus Filburn I mentioned, pretty much the complete power of Congress to regulate the manufacturing process. This is clearly contrary to what the founders intended and to what the meaning of commerce, of the commerce power actually is. So, a friend of mine, whose name is Gary Marbet, who heads the Montana Shooting Sports Association, drafted a bill called the Montana Firearms Freedom Act. I helped him a little bit on it, but I wasn't a core drafter. And the idea of it is to get the legislature to pass it and then to challenge Darby and Wickard versus Filburn directly in court. The Montana legislature agreed, and a Democratic governor signed the bill. And so now we've got litigation bubbling through the federal court. The idea is to let it get to the Supreme Court, to maybe give the Supreme Court a little bit more of an opportunity to pare back the commerce power if it's so inclined. That's why it was passed, to set up this litigation.
God bless you.
I will tell you, it's not. Some people have said it's designed to be an act of nullification. Mm-hmm. It's not. I don't favor nullification. It's an act specifically to set up a court test on the issue.
So how about the executive branch and things that they're doing to usurp authority through executive orders declaring control of forms of commerce and so forth?
Okay. The question of executive orders is a very interesting one. And unfortunately, I've got to give you a longer answer than I want to. There are executive orders that are very, very good. There are executive orders that are very, very bad. There are executive orders that are fully constitutional. There are executive orders that are not. The president is given the responsibility by the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. How does he do that? Does he go out and personally enforce the laws himself? No. The president administers the executive branch. And the way, or one way, or part of the administration of the executive branch is to issue orders. Here's how you will enforce this law. Or here's what you'll do when you act in this way. This is what you'll take into consideration. That kind of executive order is not only constitutional, it's absolutely necessary to carry out the president's duties. Another kind of executive order is when Congress passes a law which says something like, the United States shall not sell ammunition or arms to any government that the president determines is a terrorist state. But the president issues an executive order determining that, let's say, Italy is a terrorist state. It may be a foolish executive order, but it's still certainly a valid one. And so the president is given some of that flexibility by Congress. Where executive orders come over to the bad side is when they violate the Constitution. Either the law that authorizes them goes beyond the Constitution, or the president simply ignores the Constitution. The president is given the responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The Affordable Care Act right now is the law of the land. When the president of the United States issues an order saying, we're not going to enforce what the law clearly requires, that's a violation of a core constitutional responsibility. This is the responsibility of taking care that the laws be faithfully executed isn't just an American constitutional responsibility. It goes back before the Constitution, back to the King of England. The reason why the English kicked out James II in 1689 is because he purported to pick and choose among what laws should be enforced. Well, that kind of executive order strikes at the very heart of British and American constitutionalism, in my view.
We've got time for just one more quick question.
Sure. My name is Juan Daniel Ramirez. I'm a computer science major.
God bless you.
my question is, you said that things are, states can do certain programs better than the federal government. Shouldn't states get more power than the federal government, since certain things work out better at the state level than the federal government level?
Well, that's part of what I'm arguing for today. I'm arguing that we have, you know, there's a balance here. There are things that, you can't expect the states to carry on national defense, right? Also, the states in the past have sometimes abused their own citizens, for example, by sanctioning slavery or denial of the right to vote based on certain impermissible categories. It's altogether appropriate for the federal government to maintain those areas. So there's a balance here. I do believe that the balance has gone too far in the direction of the federal government, and the founders would certainly believe it's gone way too far in the direction of the federal government. I don't think it's any accident that you have seen over the past 20 years or so, a massive devolution of power throughout the world. You've seen more and more power being administered locally. Consider the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union used to be one massive intercontinental country. The Soviet Union is now 15 separate republics. Yugoslavia is now 5 separate republics. Czechoslovakia is 2. The Sudan is now 2 separate governments. There have been major devolutions of power in Great Britain. We now have a Scottish Parliament for the first time since 1707. And we have a Welsh Parliament as well. We have greater home rule for the provinces within Canada. There is this really, as I said, I don't think this is an accident. I think that the general trends are in the direction of more devolution, more decentralization. And if we try to swim upstream against the tide, we're making a mistake. I want to thank you all very much. It's been a real honor.